Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, peas. Just when you thought you were going to get rid of us,
we're back. It's our new idea after 4.5 years to do a summer series.
It is. They're not new episodes because we are extremely mediocre, as you are aware, and we are human beings and we are having a holiday like everyone else in Australia. But we thought you might still like to hear some of our favourite episodes.
So we've chosen a few that we know people really enjoyed at the time, and you might have missed them. So please enjoy.
Enjoy them. And if you didn't miss them, you can
listen to them again.
I love re-watching things.
Same.
So I love re-listening. It's comforting. You know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Enjoy. And we'll see you soon.
Bye.
We would like to acknowledge that this podcast maiden is being held on Aboriginal land, the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And we would like to pay respect to their elders past, present and emerging, and their multiple birth parents with children with disabilities.
And this week, we're speaking to Naz Campanella, the National Disability Affairs Reporter for the ABC.
This podcast contains truth, laughter, and the occasional F word, so it's not really suitable for children.
Sometimes you just have to get your shits out. Shit, 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 shit. That's right, this is a language warning. Oh, shit.
Hello, Mandy.
Hello, Kate.
Here we come from freezing cold Melbourne. One day we're going to say it's sunny and warm, but not today.
Not today.
No, it's for those of you who are not in Melbourne, it's supposed to be a top of 11 today and it's November. Apparently there's 50 centimetres of snow forecast for the hills.
Yes, I've seen the snow. My goodness.
Anyway, it's spring, we think.
Yeah.
We have so to go back to the indigenous seasons.
Yes, that's right.
Much
that's
better.
Right.
Yep, yep.
So anyway, we're here, but we're very excited
very
today.
Very excited.
A guest. So would you like to say hello and introduce yourself? Naz, would you like to say hello and introduce yourself?
It would help if I could find the microphone. Hello, I'm Naz Campanella, and I'm very happy to be here with Mandy and Kate.
Oh, we're super excited. I've listened to Naz's voice for a long time, as everyone knows who listens to this podcast. I'm a Triple J tragic. So, yes, I have listened to her beautiful voice for years, but she doesn't do the news on Triple J anymore.
No, I did that for 7.5 years, which was, you know, a good time, but it was time to move on.
Yes.
So I'm totally blind and I also have a neurological condition called Charcot-Marie-Tooth, and we'll just call it CMT for short.
Mm.
And basically that affects my sensitivity in my arms, legs, hands and feet, and affects my balance and my muscle tone, and that's really it. More prone to falls, that kind of thing. So, yeah, and I am the National Disability Affairs Reporter at the ABC. I've been doing that for about 2 years, but I'm currently on maternity leave with my 8-month-old Lachlan.
How are you finding maternity leave?
I'm loving it. Yeah. I wish I could say that I was missing work, and I think everyone's quite surprised that I'm not. I think everyone thought I would get very bored very quickly, but I've got us booked up for, you know, Gymboroo, swimming lessons, music classes. We have coffee dates with lots of, you know, our mum friends. Our house is always packed with babies now. And so I'm finding that there's actually lots to do and it's lots of fun. And I'm just loving, I feel like he's now turned this kind of fun corner and he's got this little personality. Months. Yeah. So it's, I feel like if I'd gone back now, it wouldn't have been right for me. It's just I'm learning so much about him now. And so, I've extended my maternity leave.
Oh, good on you.
So how long are you having off?
I'm having 13 months off, which is really nice because I feel like I've sort of been working, you know, full steam ahead since I was kind of 22 full time and just feel like I wanted, I won't say a break because raising a baby is not break,
it's not.
But just something different from the daily grind of news. And, you know, news can be pretty grim and there's not much good stuff that makes the news these days. And so it's just nice to have, you know, nursery rhymes and books and you know, happy things going on every day.
That's so true.
Because
I think I know for myself when I've had a particularly tricky couple of weeks, I'll drop out of the news for a few days. I'm like,
definitely. Oh,
but you can't do that when you're a newsreader.
No,
and my husband is also in news. He is the breakfast presenter on new ABC News Radio. And so not only is it my work that obviously comes home with us, but it's his work as well. And a lot of the conversations we have, although we do try and keep it to a minimum, you know, about work, are about news and what's going on and you know, did you see XYZ and how terrible is that? And also he works ridiculous hours. Like we both work ridiculous hours. He's up at 3:15. He's at the desk at 4 a.m. He's on air from 6 to 10. Like it's crazy hours. And I, you know, before I had Lockie, was working unbelievable hours. So
yeah, because you were the breakfast news reporter as well on Triple J.
For a time. But you would do, you know, I was working across lots of different platforms and reading and producing and doing lots of different things. And so, you know, you might have 2 6 a.m. shifts on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday might be 4 a.m. and then the other two might be, you know, 1 p.m. So your sleeping patterns were always sort of up and down. You constantly felt jet lagged. And so,
you were prepared then for motherhood.
You know, it's funny. Yes, in a sense, I feel like we were. It's not like our friends who work 9 to 5 where sleep deprivation smacks them in the face like they've never known before. For us, we're so used to it that getting up at, you know, every 2 hours when he was going through sleep regressions or, you know, even now at 8 months, he's still getting up for one feed between 1 and 3 a.m. It's nothing for me. It's just is what it is.
You might be able to go back to bed. So that's pretty great.
The problem at the moment is that I'm going back to bed, but I'm finding myself wide awake.
Yeah.
And so it's my time to kind of read novels or listen, you know, catch up on text messages. So I write all my text messages to people, but I can't send them until like a decent hour, like 5 a.m. Unless the people I'm writing to are also mums and it's on like Facebook Messenger where I know that they're probably going to be up feeding as well.
Well, you did message us at 4 a.m.
So. You
and I was awake. So
there you go. See, that was on Instagram. So I was like, oh well, you may or may not have your phone on.
Yeah, that's
Like, so but if it's a text message, I'm kind of like, I'll write them all and then leave them till 6 a.m. and then just go boom, 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 boom.
Well, it's efficiency. We're all for it.
Oh yeah,
that's right. And that's right.
I mean, it would be nice to be able to fall back to sleep, but there's something about that 4 a.m., 5 a.m. feed that you know within an hour or two you have to be up. It's really hard to fall back asleep. It's not like an afternoon nap. It's weird.
Well, it kind of takes you, you know, 20 minutes to get off, and then you're sleeping for 20 minutes, and then, you know, it takes you another 10 minutes to kind of actually get up. Mm. What's the point?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. What is the point? Especially if you're used to not sleeping, then you're fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I find people used to tell me, you're just going to have to sleep when the baby sleeps. And I try really hard to do that. But then it's like, when do you wash the dishes? When do you put the load of washing on? When do you do everything else? So I do try and do that. But, you know, after everything else is done.
I know. That's right. Anyone who says that doesn't have a little baby, because you still have to have food in the fridge or, you know, whatever else is coming and going around your life. So I think more likely you have a nap on the couch than actually go back to bed and have a full sleep.
Yeah, I even just resting, like just lying down on the couch for 20 minutes is just good enough for me, and it doesn't even matter if I don't really fall asleep. It's just nice to zone out for a minute.
Oh, I could talk about sleep all day because it's my actual job. But, let's get to some of our questions.
Yes, let's do that.
Just because I want to hear your answer to Kate's first question.
Yes. Okay. So our first question is, do you have a favourite band or a song specifically that sort of pumps you up in the good times or gets you through the down times?
Oh, look, we love music at our place. Mm. It's on constantly. Mm. I couldn't put my finger on any one type of thing. But for good or bad, I'm playing Lucky a lot of Beyonce.
And that's good.
a lot of Lionel Richie. One of my favorite songs of all time is Dancing on the Ceiling.
Yeah.
Lots of Lionel Richie, lots of Something for Kate, Aussie band from ages ago.
Yeah.
I was listening to the Yeah Yeah Yeahs the other day which I haven't listened to in ages. Bon Iver.
Mm.
I listened to, when I was pregnant, I was listening to a lot of classical music. And there was one in particular, Yuruma, who is a South Korean pianist. And I was playing really the same album over and over again. And I'd loved it for years, but I was playing it to Lockie when I was pregnant. Mm. And I actually use it a lot to get him off to sleep. Yes. It's really beautiful, soft music. So, yeah.
Oh, good. I thought you'd have an eclectic music taste, and you do.
Yeah.
We do, yeah. And then my husband comes home and adds, you know, beautiful jazz to it, lots of Miles Davis, Radiohead, you know, there's anything and everything in our place.
Oh.
I like it.
Tell us, did you win any awards at school?
Oh, look, I did win a few.
Now's your time to brag. Tell us everything.
I was a competitive swimmer, so I won, you know, a few things in that. Mm. I was Ducks of my school in the 12.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, which was fun. I got a Prime Minister's Award at the time for the HSC as well.
Wow.
And then a few like other little bits and pieces, you know. Nothing worth mentioning.
They're all worth mentioning.
I recently got a cool award for work, actually. It was from the Australian Network on Disability, and it was called the Confidence Changemaker Award or something like that. It was the first one that they'd held, and it was basically for contributing, you know, to change within your workplace around disability and inclusion. So I was pretty proud to win that one, to be honest.
Mandy and I stay strong. We're never winning an award. We get nominated every year.
And then we lose them. That's on brand.
Yeah,
so we're
very disappointed if we won now. So yeah. To change our whole shtick.
But we love celebrating people that do win meaningful awards, because that's what's important to us, is that they're meaningful and not trite.
Yeah.
So that's where that sort of comes from.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so our last question is, why are you a P or part of the P community? And you've sort of answered it already, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm a person with disability, the blindness and the CMT.
So if we go back to your earliest memories, was the CMT a really big part of your life?
Well, it was, but we didn't know at the time. So basically, I was struggling to read Braille. We didn't know why I wasn't able to read. It was just, I was a really fast learner. I was really, you know, pretty bright kid.
Yeah.
But just wasn't able to actually read Braille. And it wasn't until I was sort of 10 after, you know, a couple of years of struggling, having teachers say sort of nasty things about me being lazy, et cetera, that we went off and had some tests done. And that's where it was discovered. It is my mum has it as well, but obviously she didn't know at the time. So it didn't manifest for her until sort of, you know, 40s, I think.
Right.
And so, yeah, so she found out through that kind of diagnosis as well.
Yeah.
Actually, when you talk about school, were you in a mainstream school? What school?
Yeah,
did you go
to? I've been to the whole gamut. I started out at a special school and so went pretty young, to be honest. I was sort of four and a half. Mm. And but it was pretty early on where the teachers kind of encouraged my parents to have me transferred into the mainstream system. And we tried a number of different schools in the system. It was kind of a slow and very gradual transition from one system to the other, and it ended up being the best thing for me.
Yeah, definitely. And once you realized that Braille reading was going to be really, really tricky, how did you transition to learning to read?
Yeah, so that was interesting because I was near five by this point. So I was about 10. So, you know, more than most of falling further and further back to school. And the other one, you know, left the school, thank goodness. She was kind of useless and not very helpful or supportive at all. And this new teacher was really encouraging and supportive and introduced new sorts of technology like audiobooks and screen reading software on computers and different Braille machines where I could write in Braille because I knew how to write Braille. But the machines would, you know, spit it out in print for the teachers and they would also talk. They also had like an audio component attached to it so I could hear what I'd written as opposed to, you know, feeling it on a screen. So that's how it all happened. And that really did transform everything for me.
I was going to say that must have been life changing.
Yeah, I was really not interested at school up until that point. Yeah. I was feeling really down and depressed about the fact that there was clearly something going on and no one was listening to me. It caused quite a rift between my parents because my mum was very much, you know, the teachers are saying we just need to try harder. And my dad was saying, no, I think she is. This is just not working. Yeah. But I mean, for no reason, it wasn't that one was right or wrong. It was just, you know, I think sometimes you trust that the teachers have all the answers and they don't. And, you know, when you've never had a child with these sort of specific needs, I think you don't really know to trust your gut, you know, until you have an experience like that. And then from then on, you know that you always need to trust your gut. Mm. So,
And I think we're all programmed or conditioned to think that there are people that are smarter than us, that know more than us.
And, always, you know? Yeah. And especially people who are very strong in their views and a little overbearing, intimidating. You know, it's very easy to see that you're wrong and that they might be right.
Yeah. Definitely.
Outside of school, did you have any connection with other people that were blind?
Yeah, my parents made a really big effort to sort of go each school holidays, send me on sort of family camps, or, you know, camps with other kids who were vision impaired through the special school. Even though I wasn't going to the special school anymore, we still had a connection with them, and they ran camps for kids where, you know, we'd go away and stay in a house from Monday to Friday and get to go to the movies and do work during the day, you know, you know, reading, learning how to sort of do things with Braille and all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, the night times we'd get to cook dinners and choose what we're going to eat and go to the shops and it was fun. And we also did family camps as well. So a couple of times a year we'd go away on a weekend away and there'd be other families with vision impaired kids. And I've, you know, I've still got some of those friends today. So it's lovely.
Yeah. Important.
Yeah, because, well, I went to mainstream school and there was no one vision impaired there. So I don't think I'm older than you, but in the 80s, they were all in special schools.
Everyone.
You didn't have a choice, you know?
No. Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, I was educated from K to 12 in the Catholic education right. system in Sydney. And at that time there had been no blind student who had sat the HSE, or the high school wow. certificate in New South Wales, and certainly no one that had done schooling outside of Braille.
Yes.
Been done before, i.e. Braille wasn't going to work. So yes. It was just, you know, we kind of had to figure it out ourselves. And thank goodness I had incredible teachers. And, you know, my mum was always up at the school having
yeah.
meetings and, you know, planning meetings and all those kinds of things and chatting to all the teachers. So it was, yeah, yep. that's how it worked basically.
We did what meet was your it like? Mum. She oh, seems sorry. Pretty yes, we did. Incredible.
Yeah, we came to your live show on oh. very long, a couple of, oh God, that was years yeah. ago now.
Yep.
Pre-pandemic.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, pre-pandemic. Yeah, no, she's pretty cool.
Yeah, she is, which I think makes all the difference in life, really.
Yeah, I think, cool. and I think now that I'm a mum, like I just know that if, you know, Lockie was ever to you know, if they discover that he has disability or, you know, even regardless, really, I would probably take a very similar approach to my mum, which is be completely present with the teachers. And, you know, she used to have meetings every single term at the beginning yeah. and the end because yep. she'd want to know, okay, how's this all going to work in, yep. in DT and woodwork yep. and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, she'd want to come in and appraise it or, you know, evaluate it with the teachers at the end of the term. And she was on, you know, very good terms with the support teacher once we found yep. the right one,
yep.
you know, and she was always there fighting for things. And, you know, yep. there was a time I remember where some funding was given to the school specifically for me, my mum and the support teacher had put in oodles of applications. Yeah. It took them a very long time to put in these applications. And then I can't even remember what year I was in. So, you know, can't even remember the school, whether it was primary, high school, whatever. I went to three different schools. But basically the funding was going to be distributed among a bunch of kids. And my mum was like, hang on, we applied for that specifically yes. for this stuff, specifically for this child. There is no way. And, it, you know, if it wasn't for her advocacy,
yeah,
I don't think I'd be where I am today.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is powerful for all parents to hear, actually, because sometimes when you're in the middle of it, you feel like you're annoying people.
Well, and I think what's disappointing, yeah. What's disappointing is that she shouldn't have to have done that. Shouldn't.
No.
There should just be, you know, this is the way it's going to be. This is the system that we use and it should be fair and equitable for everybody yes. and it should just be very normal to have students with disability in yes. a mainstream yes. education setting. So it's still, while it was great that she did it, it's ridiculous that she had to. And I know, you know, through not only just social circles but also more widely in my work, I report on this all the time that this is parents are constantly having to fight for funding, fight for inclusion, fight for access to even the most basic of needs and requirements at a school level.
And I'm interested, sorry, Kate, just because that sounds like that I have to go through all that sort of stuff too. Could you tell that had an impact on your mum, or did she just hide all that? Like some, if she had some stress around those meetings and the advocacy.
Oh, you know what? I'd actually, looking back, argue that she never found it stressful. She just knew she was on a mission and she was like a bull in a china shop and just did it and just thought, I don't care what anyone thinks or says. This is just, you know, I think there were times where she got quite upset, but I think for her, you know, she never really showed weakness or anything because she just thought, no, I'm just going to keep plugging away at this and it'll all be fine. And I've sort of taken that same positive kind of strength going into everything. I mean, I've had to fight to even get work and, you know, be on school and certain things at university. And so I'm definitely, I've taken after her in that regard.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, I mean, strong women change the world.
Yes, so, that's right.
Yeah, they do.
Really, really do. So did you always know that you wanted to do journalism or writing or?
Yeah, always. I knew I always wanted to do something in radio, I think just because I'd grown up with it. It was on from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep. You know, I listened to whatever it was, the hottest 30 countdown at night before going to sleep. You know, it used to be one of those annoying people who called the station all the time. You know,
me too.
Played in all the comps. I remember watching Video Hits, and I used to just constantly call the competition hotlines, and they were like at the time like the 1-800 blah blah blah, and it wasn't free. And I remember my parents getting this huge bill. And to be fair, and I, you know, obviously hated them at the time, but I totally see the merit now, especially now that I'm a mum. Like, they made me crack open the piggy bank, and I had to actually pay the bill out of my. And I tell you, I never entered a competition on that front ever again. I was always interested in radio. I loved the way people sounded. And I think what confirmed it for me was when I was at 15, I was year 9 and did community radio. So my best friend and I hosted our own program for a couple of years. And, yeah, I just loved it. And then worked really hard to get into the journalism degree of my choice. And, did lots of internships during uni because I sort of thought, having a degree is not going to be the only thing that gets you a job. No. It doesn't get anyone a job these days anywhere.
No.
Yep. So basically did lots of unpaid work for sort of 4 years. And that was it, not just radio stations, it was TV, it was print, it was, you know, magazines, the whole lot. And then, was very lucky to land the job at the ABC. It was a cadetship and it was a 12-month, essentially a traineeship in the Sydney newsroom. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky to get that. There were thousands of people that applied. I mean, there were thousands every year. There were 10 spots that year across the country. Wow. I was one of them. And, you know, I'd had months and months of, you know, people discriminating against me, basically, getting me to come in for interviews. And I generally always did get interviews because my CV looked good. I had, you know, as I said, lots of internships and things. Never disclosed my disabilities, but people obviously saw when I walked in with a white cane into the interview rooms. And that's when it all kind of fell apart, except when I went into the ABC.
I just think I was talking to a group of employers and they were saying, you know, it's really important that we have people with disabilities working for us and blah, blah. And I said, and do you ever disclose to them that, you know, your workplace may have stairs or may have, you know, I mean, for my children, is it really bright in there? Is it really loud? Like, do you do anything to make it so that anybody could work there? And they said, oh, no, we'd never really thought about that.
Interesting.
Straight away that you're going for the job, they haven't even thought about,
some people can't even get into the building to do an interview.
That's right.
So, yeah.
It all fell apart, what were some examples?
Oh, they would straight out say, how the hell can you be a journalist? You can't see.
Oh, my God.
Or they'd just be really, really cold. Like, you could just tell they were just kind of going through the motions, like looking at each other thinking, let's just interview this chick, but she's clearly not getting the job. So there was lots of that. But, you know, that's okay. You'll even learn. And it was depressing at the time.
Yeah, it must have
been. It's been quite nice, I will admit, to now that I obviously am, you know, 12 years into working at the ABC and have, you know, a little bit of a profile and all that kind of thing, and to have some people who, you know, offered internships but then reneged on it, or organisations who, you know, didn't give me the time of day now ask me to do things, and it's quite a nice pleasure to knock them back or reject them.
Yes.
Take ages to answer them and Yes, I would believe.
Generally don't hold a grudge, but sometimes it is quite nice.
Oh yeah.
When you were a young woman and you were facing some of that stuff and you said it was depressing, how did you sort through that? Did you get help? Or what are some of the ways that you were able to get resilient to some of that?
Yeah, good question. I think you just build it over time, and I've had so much of that. I think initially having a really crappy support teacher who was anything but supportive when I was first diagnosed with the CMT was that first kind of thing where I just went, and I obviously didn't know it at the time. I was 10. What the hell did I know?
Yeah.
But
you know,
I look back on it and think, I'm not going to let anyone treat me like that again. Mm. And so there were lots of those little things, you know, just little things that friends did or didn't do, or you know, over time you just build that resilience. And in the moment, in the throes of being denied the jobs, I was obviously going home feeling very teary. And but I think sometimes I also just thought it was funny. I was like, what? Why on earth would a group of people think that that's okay?
Yeah.
Like, on what planet is that okay?
Yes.
And a question like, how can you be a journalist? Well, you've seen the portfolio. I've actually done it. So, I guess I'd ask you a question of how do you think I can't?
Yes.
And it was also just, I guess, telling of the fact that they really couldn't. They probably weren't very smart people in, in terms of their job and you know, textbook smart and all that sort of thing and worldly. But also a lack of common sense of saying, well, there's a few ways to skin a cat.
Yeah.
And you've just clearly been working in the same organization with the same people, the same types of people.
Yep.
And this is why you can't think outside the box.
Boring.
So, really. But the best thing really is to get through it was surrounding myself with good friends and family, people who did value me me and who just kept saying, okay, you know what, you don't want to work at a workplace that treats people like that anyway.
You really don't.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And so how long were you at the ABC before you started reading the news?
Oh, so I did my cadetship in Sydney and then I went off to be a regional reporter in Bega on the New South Wales Far South Coast and was there for 12 months and that was beautiful. And I did start news reading there. I had a panel operator and I remember my first news bulletin. It was so bad I actually thanked people for listening at the end.
And we've all felt like that.
It's like our first episode. Yes.
my now husband was actually there. That's where we met. And he was actually there at the time, like laughing, like, oh my God, you did not just thank people for listening. Don't do that. And so that was quite funny. But yeah, so started news reading there and it was just one bulletin at 5:30 in the afternoons. I think it was 4 days a week. Yeah, because I don't think you did it on Fridays.
Yep.
And then, yeah, I had a panel operator. So all I had to do was worry about actually, you know, reading the news with the little system that had been developed, which was basically listening to the screen reading software on my computer with a little headphone and then repeating what I was hearing. And that's all it was, me and the computer, just one little audio stream. Mm. Then when I got the job at Triple J a year later and moved back to Sydney, we ramped up that system and it wasn't just one audio stream, it became four. And so it was screen reading software telling me what to say. Mm. It was a clock, counting me in and counting down. So, because it's all very specifically timed.
Yes.
And then it was myself coming through the microphone and then all the little audio snippets of, you know, Prime Minister and all, you know, different things that you'd play. Plus, we obviously didn't have the panel operator then. I paneled myself. So there was a lot to learn in those early stages. And it was a bit full on. And I, when I was reading a news bulletin, I couldn't concentrate on anything else.
No.
Couldn't think about anything else. It was just, lots of hands going everywhere.
I know I heard, I think it might have been Ben and Liam that tried to do it. To read the news the way you do, and they could not do it at all.
Yeah, look, a few of the guys at Triple J over the years have tried, and look, you know, I don't think I'm a genius. I think anyone could, you know, I wasn't great at it at first either.
Mm-mm.
It's about practice, right? Mm. And so any of those guys could have done it.
Yeah, but it was still funny, and it was, you know.
It was
a bit
great.
Of entertaining.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
But it is nice to be, you know, the only newsreader in the world. And I say that confidently because we'd know about them by now if there was anyone else who was blind who does that live to air or who did that live to air. So, you know, it felt, it was one of those moments where you sort of don't realize at the time until you sort of in it when people start ringing and saying, you know, I'm also vision impaired or I also have a disability and this is really, I hate the word inspiring, but motivational and this is really empowering for me and thank you and how else can we do it? And, you know, people used to call me from, you know, I had calls from universities in the UK, the United States, New Zealand saying, you know, we've got students who are vision impaired, you know, is there any advice you can give or you know, not only give them but me as a teacher, a lecturer, and also just talk about the system that you use so we can try and sort of do something similar. So it's then that you realise actually this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's super, what you're doing. Super cool. Yeah,
that's quite significant that people are calling on you. Is that sort of the first taste of being in the world of advocacy?
No, look, I'd kind of done it a little bit. You know, all my life, I guess I was, you know, in lots of little ad campaigns for different braille machines and different assistive technology and did a lot of sort of mentoring and you know, partnerships and things. But then I could really see the impact of not only advocacy, but just because I don't see myself as an advocate. I'm a journalist. They're very different things.
Yes.
Yeah, they're very, very different things. Mm. But, you know, advocacy means that you can have an opinion. And I'm not allowed to as a journalist. So,
got it.
You know, I still very much believe in, you know, the cornerstone of what I do is sharing a story, but sharing all facets of a story, you know, even the ones that a lot of disability advocates would not want in the story. It's important for people to make up their own mind about, you know, how something is. I simply present the story in a balanced and fair way. But sorry to get back to your question. Yes, I could see the power of me being, you know, someone in the media with a profile, with a disability and what that was doing for other people. Mm. And it was nice to be able to provide whatever it was people were getting out of it.
Yes.
Well, I think it's like everything for a lot of us, we can't be what we can't envisage or hear or see. Like we're like, how can I be a that if I've never seen anyone like me?
Well, I mean,
like
when you think about it, a lot of people with disability, you'll hear lots of people say this, you know, for a long time it was just Paralympians and they're amazing. Yes. I love them and think they're amazing. But I was never, you know, I swam, but I was never going to be, you know, a Paralympic swimmer. Yes. I don't want to be a Paralympian. And other people don't. Other people don't. No, and, you know, some do. But so it's good that we now have loads of people that are, you know, in media, in writing, in whatever it is, you know.
Well, it should just be representative.
Like I met a bunch of people this week. I was hosting an event, an awards night, and there were some people there, you know, talking about a blind chocolatier in Brisbane and then someone who's blind who's a chef in Sydney and, you know, just all these different things that people can kind of have as role models. Mm. And I didn't really have any.
No, that's right.
Reflected me and what I wanted to be.
Yeah. Your children are lucky. Well, I'm grateful that my children are growing up.
Yeah, well, they stand on the shoulders.
They do. That's right.
But I know even for my boys who are 17, because, one has autism, but they both have really severe ADHD, which really actually affects them almost more in some ways. And people constantly say to them, oh, well, you must be really good at footy or you must love sport because that's the only people that you ever hear that come out and say, oh, I had ADHD, but I joined the footy club and then I was the most active player on the team. And then,
Or what about, you know, autistic people who, you know, everyone just assumes they're amazing at maths.
Yes.
They're going to be all engineers.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
You know, why? Just because three people who were autistic that you met were? Like, we're all different people.
I know, really. And so I think for them still now, like we met someone on the weekend who said to them, well, you must love sport. And they were like, no, not really. No, we don't. Like, it's just such a stereotype. And I understand people are meaning well. But it will be really good one day, maybe, when that all stops and people just ask them, what do you like?
And for us to learn as mothers, to learn from mothers that have gone before us, so then we can help to channel that in our children as well, so that we're not just assuming they're going to go down one route in their life.
Yeah.
Of course not.
Yeah. No. Well, once you live with a person, you're like, oh, they're just that person.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it takes a little bit of that mystery away. And so when you decided to have your beautiful baby, were you worried about the CMT?
No, look, it's just one of those things where, you know, if it happens, it happens. You know, we don't know what causes my blindness either. Right. That is also genetic. My brother has it.
Right.
And so, you know, there were lots of things we had to think about. Mm. And also think about from my perspective, whether I could carry.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I meant like your strength and yeah.
Yeah. So all of that stuff. And it was a big thing. I needed to really work on it before we even got pregnant. Mm-hmm. So it was a case of working with an exercise physiologist to build up the strength in my arms, my legs, to make sure that I could get up off the couch holding a baby in my arms without using my arms to get up off the couch, making sure I could actually continue to get around on, you know, my feet while I was pregnant as my belly got bigger, avoid falling over, which, you know, did happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I worked with an exercise physiologist for about 2 years before, and I'm still working with them because now, you know, Lockie's 9 kilos now.
Yes.
And so that's been really important, but also working with an occupational therapist to make sure that I was able to do all the little, you know, the nappy changing, the wrapping, how to set up the room, what equipment to buy, all of that sort of thing. So that was really important as well. I wasn't worried about it, but I just wanted to know what was out there in terms of supports and services so we could put all the things in place and I could do what I could possibly do to prepare.
I really appreciated reading that on Instagram and seeing all that preparation. My husband has a hearing loss, severe hearing loss, and we did nothing and then we had twins. And I just think, the poor man, I would just bring a baby into him and he couldn't hear and I'd just say, take it! You know, didn't have anything organised and I just,
you know,
back and I feel disappointed that we didn't put in any work or ask for some help about that.
The other thing is, though, I think that you can't prepare for everything. So, Lockie is crawling around now.
Yes.
Having solids. I hadn't thought about how I was going to manage all of those things. I kind of just prepared for the very, very early newborn stage, maybe like the first 3 months. Yep. And then I hadn't thought beyond that.
Well, that's all you can do when you're pregnant. Yeah. I mean, you can't look too far ahead.
And I think like any person in any stage of life, you've sort of also just got to leave it up to the experience and see how it works and try different things. I guess my point is you're not going to know what's going to work. And, you know, the other thing is when I was thinking about getting pregnant and then did, I very quickly realized there's not a lot out there in terms of equipment. Most of the people I've spoken to with various disabilities or different kinds, not just the ones I have, basically said that they had to buy, you know, regular stuff from Baby Bunting or whatever it was, and then just adapt it for their needs. So there was nothing out there for them, which is really disappointing. And there's no kind of there is a lack of sort of support groups and parenting groups for people with disability. I've noticed a few now. I also, there was a real gap in knowledge and services in the hospital system. Now, I was really lucky. I was public patient, very big Sydney hospital, the most beautiful team of midwives and obstetricians. Yep. And they were very honest with me from the very beginning, saying, we've never had a disabled mum before. Wow. Don't know how this works. Now, most of them had 30-ish years experience in midwifery.
That is incredible.
And they didn't have resources. The birthing classes, the videos that they showed were not even in English, let alone things that were accessible.
Yes.
So what was good about them, and I definitely had, you know, royal treatment, was because they kind of said, we've got nothing, we're working from the absolute ground, let's build this together. Let's build it together. And I think that is why I had the best team. They just came up with a sort of individual care plan. They put everything in there that they thought needed to be in there, but they also consulted with me very closely about what I thought should be in there. And they use their networks. So I had one sort of high risk, I was in a high risk program. So I had my high risk midwife who, you know, went and spoke to her parent educators at the hospital and her networks to say, do you have anything? Do you know of anything? Mm. And in the end, you know, my husband and I went in for sort of face-to-face, hands-on kind of nappy changing and, you know, how to bath baby and how to do this and how to do that. And I actually think every parent should, you know, disabled or non-disabled should go in for that stuff, because doing it on Zoom just isn't sufficient.
And
you know, the care that I got, I mean, you know, even the smallest of things that people don't do, my team did, you know, they had obviously told all the nurses, you know, when you're going into that room, knock on the door, tell her who you are, tell your name, explain what you're going to be doing. And those things seem like really small things, but they're things that people very easily neglect to do. And in particular in the medical system. Mm. The other thing was, I've often talked in the last couple of months about my cesarean and the experience I had. I have a real phobia of hospitals. I've spent so much time having, going into theatre and all that sort of thing. I was really terrified. It had to be an emergency cesarean because we had a few complications with Lockie. And so I was terrified of the, I think it's called spinal tap. And I was waiting outside the theatre to go in, and the anaesthetist was just beautiful. She came out, introduced herself, brought the rest of the team out. They all told me their names, their roles, where they were going to be, what they were going to be doing, asked whether I wanted, you know, them to talk to me or just all be silent. You know, did I want music? They described everything to me, when it was happening, why it was happening. And you know what? It was the best experience. Like, obviously, you know, there was tugging and pulling, and I felt like people were washing dishes in my stomach, but or in my uterus. But it was also just the most beautiful experience. And it's funny, my husband always says, you know, he almost felt non-existent while we were in hospital, because the midwives, the nurses, everyone would just come in and talk to me, and it was like he didn't exist. And he loved it, because he often sees, you know, he often has experiences where we'll be at a cafe and people will say, oh, what does she want to order? What will she be having to drink? We'll go to a doctor's surgery and they'll say, oh, what's her name? What's her date of birth? And so for him, it was really nice for them to see me as mum, mum of baby Lockie. And, you know, he was just there as the dad.
And as much as our partners or whatever are there, they did not give birth. really is our bodies that
– It is.
It's a crash course of learning how to take care of your own body while learning how to take care of someone else's. And it's
absolutely. And I think, you know, it was really nice. We weren't kicked out of hospital. I was there for 4 days before I had him and 5 days after. And it was all very much led by us, and when I felt comfortable and, you know, just – any service I needed was given to us, which was fantastic.
Nothing quite like those first few days. I know that, you know, you get emotional in the day three blues and all that, but when you first hold your
day
baby,
three, I was like that for 2 weeks.
Yes, of course. I
know. We like to minimize it as women. I don't know why, but yes.
I tell everyone. And my beautiful sister-in-law has just had a baby, and like a few days ago, and I actually say this not just to her but to everyone, like, oh, so, you know, just bring a box of tissues in with you when you go and give birth, because you'll cry for days, like days and days and days.
Dripping into the cornflakes, tears dripping. I was like, oh, just eat them anyway.
and it's actually quite – and you don't know why, and it just happens for no reason. Like, sometimes at home I'd just be sitting there, like, having fed Lockie, and he'd be asleep on my chest, and I'd just burst into tears and, like, just say, you know. And it was like – it was – just it was, and it wasn't even always like sad tears.
No, of course not.
It was mostly just, it was just happy tears.
Well, you're falling in love as well.
Yes, that's right.
You're like, wow, I'm falling in love with a little tiny human, and my body was just cut open, and I'm bleeding.
I'm trying to breastfeed.
And my nipples are sore, and all my hormones are everywhere. So what, nobody knows what to do with those feelings. So, yeah, there is lots of crying. Buy the good tissues, the Kleenex aloe vera.
And so-and-so is coming over and the house is a mess.
Yes, someone's coming over. And, I remember
all of those things.
Breastfeeding the twins and thinking, well, if you want to walk in and see this, that's what you're going to see. I've got no top on. This is the only way of doing this. So this is how it is now.
yep.
We have to normalize it all. But
We do.
You've written a bit on your Instagram about now that he's moving and putting some sounds on him so that you can find him. Is that who's guided you on that? Did you sort that out yourself?
A bit of both. So basically I had an OT recommend a few things like squeaky shoes and, you know, you could put a bell on him and, you know, friends have all said, you know, you can put a bell on him, that kind of thing. But we are still in regular contact with our sort of, what are they called, family, child, early childhood community nurse thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that who, and ours is just a godsend. She's amazing. And I was talking to her about it and she actually suggested these little toys that rattle. And so, you know, there's like a little hippo and a cow, I think. Yes. And you can pop them on his wrists
on
his ankles.
Oh, yes.
And he thinks they're really fun because, you know, they're animals and he plays around with them. And I can hear him. But also, to be fair, we've got timber floorboards. We don't have carpet at all. So I hear him. Yeah. Like I can hear his hands and feet tapping along the.
Babies are noisy.
Yeah,
and he's actually incredibly vocal. I think because, well, look, I mean, let's face it, you know, the son of two journalists, he was never going to be quiet. But I think because I can't make eye contact with him, I've tried really hard to be very vocal and to talk to him constantly, even about nothing. Like if he was just sitting in a little rocker next to me while I washed the dishes, I would just talk to him about what I was washing in the sink.
Like, beautiful.
So that he constantly heard my voice because I sort of had to compensate for not being able to do you know, other things. And so I think because of that, he's really vocal. So he's not a quiet kid anyway. The only time he has been quiet, I put him down for 2 seconds in his room, went to put the nappy in the bin, came back, couldn't find him, and got on my hands and knees, and I found him licking the pram wheel. Gross.
It's all good immune system building.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the mischief making
but
when
I
they're
think
quiet.
Children, if children are quiet, it is. I used to get an adrenaline rush. Oh my goodness, I can't hear them.
Where are they?
But I think, you know, I don't think he knows that I can't see. But I think he knows that Mum works a bit differently to Dad and you know Grandma and Nonna. So you know Grandpa and So. And I think he knows that he has to make sort of more noise with me.
Oh, yeah, I think definitely. I remember all of my kids would respond much differently to me, to my husband, and to their older siblings. And so, I think we maybe don't give them enough benefit of, you know.
And it's like always adapting. I came home the other day and there was a big message on the whiteboard because Dad had his hearing aids out. Are we going to eat the pizza down the back and watch a movie? Yep. And then he answered. I thought, wow, they're always coming up with stuff in my house.
Well, you know, even little things like Lockie, when he opens his mouth when I'm feeding him, he makes a noise. Like he does this, like, you know, he's almost
clever.
Which sometimes he does do that with other people, but I feel like with me, he's like, oh gosh, if I don't do this, she's not going to put it in there. And he, you know, he turns his head towards me or taps my hand, you know. Look, I don't know whether any of this is on purpose, but, you know, it feels like it is.
I definitely think
it is. Yeah.
It's communication.
Yeah. Definitely. And so when you go back to work, are you going to go full time?
Yes.
Oh, it's, you know what, once you do it, it's okay. It's just the thought of doing it that's really hard.
I've had mixed kind of responses from people. Most people say I'm crazy.
Oh, no.
But another group of people just say it's not going to be easy, but you just do it.
You don't really know
how, but you just do. So
right or wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
And you love
your job.
We're
going to try.
And you're really good at it. And why?
I do love my job. Yeah. And look, there is a, you know, I have kind of said to my boss, it may have to be reduced and we may have to go to some sort of part-time arrangement. But for now, I'm really going to try and do the 5 days. And we've come up with a bit of a good sort of plan at home, you know, 3 days of daycare. Tom's parents will have Lockie one day, my parents another, and I will start later on a Monday so I can still do swimming lessons. So
gorgeous.
Yeah, so I'm hoping we'll find a nice little balance.
I think you will.
Yeah, and it's – Amazing being home with the kids and amazing also working. Like both of them are just a really great time in your life. And, you know, as women, we need our superannuation and we need all that stuff.
Yeah. And also I think I really want Lockie to see that he, just from a male perspective, that he sees that his mum is a hardworking woman.
Yes, absolutely.
And that, you know, Tom's going to probably have some time off when I go back initially and be at home with him for a while. And I think that's equally important. I want him to know that dad, you know, I mean, dad cooks dinner every night, so that's nothing new. But I want him to know that dad also cooks and cleans and looks after him just like mum does. And mum works just like dad does.
Yes. Definitely.
So that's really important to Tom and I.
Yeah. When I had I've always worked with the twins, and then they said to me one day, oh, did you know that somebody's mum doesn't ever go to work? Like the concept was so foreign to them, and I thought so different from when I was growing up when nobody's mum's worked.
Mm.
So, it is powerful.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I want him to respect that I work and I work really hard and that work for women is just as important.
That's right.
It sure is.
Absolutely. You know, we could talk to you forever, and we won't, but we could. Is there anything that you think, I wish they'd asked me that question, or?
No, I'm just really grateful to share what I've shared with you.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you.
Super fan. I'm a super fan. I don't even make any.
Yes. Oh,
thanks, guys.
I've loved you for a long time.
I just wanted to personally thank you for coming to our live show back in 2019. It really was enormous to us. Personally, it was enormous to me because I had some criticism for something that I'd said. And to have you come and to bring your mum was really, it really made a huge difference to me personally. And I just want to say thank you.
Mm. Oh, my pleasure. I'm one of those people who wants to come and support anyone and, you know, just see what things are all about. And I think, you guys do a good job and it's nice to be a part of the community.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Hello, peas. It's Kate here wrapping up this amazing episode with the divine Naz. Mandy and I actually recorded this last November. I am speaking to you from February. This is the magic of podcasting. We had a few things come up that we really needed to get out, and we were just so excited about those, but we're super excited about this episode, as I probably said at the beginning. It's been my dream to interview Naz. I have loved her, fangirled her from afar for a long time. So I have whipped down from the kitchen to record this outro. Mandy is probably making her own dinner as we speak. How many dinners? We don't know because we have children that like lots of different cuisines, which makes us very talented chefs. Anyway, there's no cry laugh difference this week. We just want to thank Naz so much for coming on, for sharing her life with us. She's an awesome, awesome human, as you all know. Go follow her on the socials. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to us for yet another week. We will be forever grateful that you come back and give us your time. If you'd like to, you can rate and review, and we'll see you next week.